Ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Last night in the city of brotherly love, Vice President Harris and former President Trump sparred for their first presidential debate. For the American people, what are the key takeaways? We have Kevin Satterfield and Dr. Dennis Rogers here with us today to discuss. Stay tuned. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. My name is Denise Young and I am your host for the second Wednesday edition of the show. WPFW family, brace yourselves. We have another epic conversation for you this morning. And I know I say that every time I'm here and every time I mean it. But before we get started, I'd like to take just a few moments to make a couple of acknowledgments. Today is indeed September 11th, marking the 23 years since we saw the destruction of New York's Twin Towers, and more importantly, the devastation of nearly 3,000 lives in New York and other affected states. I offer words of continued peace to all families that experienced firsthand the loss of loved ones and who were touched so personally by these events, and particularly first responders. Also, I was away from What's at Stake and did not get the opportunity to publicly acknowledge the murder of Sonya Massey on July 6, 2024. Given that one of our primary topics for this segment is police brutality, it is only fitting that we take a few moments just to pause on this. Massey called the police seeking protection from what she believed was someone lurking near her home, a potential home invasion. And instead, she needed protection from the men in blue who she allowed to cross her threshold. In her home, unarmed, and Sean Grayson, a white deputy of the Sangamon County Sheriff's Office in Woodside Township near Springfield, Illinois, unapologetically slaughtered her. It is a narrative that is all too familiar to Black folks in this country. And so the conversation can no longer be, or perhaps we are beyond the idea of what are the solutions until we recognize that these kinds of events, these murders are endemic of a country that is predicated on and thrives off of the devastation, the disparaging, the death of certain groups, and specifically African Americans, functioning as if in an apartheid state. And so I wanted to offer condolences to the Massey family, but also to our community to continue to say that we must look to each other. We must continue to understand that this is trauma, that it is not normal, and we have to look for what is systemically the issue, and push to have those systemic factors addressed. This isn't just an issue of police brutality. It is an issue of what happens when you live in a nation that functions as an apartheid state. Whew, that was a lot. Okay, I'm sorry, I had to just collect myself for a moment because I know that many of us saw that tape, and I certainly did not mean to resurrect any feelings of trauma from it, but it's a reality of what's happening. Okay, so let's get down to business. As we said, we had a very interesting and lively debate yesterday evening, and we are going to today have some really dynamic gentlemen join us in conversation to discuss that debate, give a little bit of insight to what we saw, what it means, and particularly what it means for the African-American community of voters. And so I'd like to take this time to welcome my guests, both of whom have been on, been guests of WPFW's What's at Stake, and just have been wonderful providers of information and connecting with our WPFW family. So I want to say good morning to Kevin Satterfield and Dr. Dennis Rogers. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Good to hear your voice. Good to be here.
Oh, good.
Hey, it's that time again. Join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K run walk for total fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details on how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 202-888-5484. That's 202-888-5484. Meet him to 7 p.m. WPFW, making a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Are you passionate about eradicating air pollution? Would you like to participate in the Environmental Justice Artivist Fellows Transformative Community Art Project in Ward 5, Washington, D.C.? We're seeking Ward 5 professional and amateur photographer portraits that capture the theme of what clean air in Ward 5 should be. Selected submissions will be featured in the Up in the Air mural design, which will be installed in a prominent Ward 5 location in fall 2024. Submission is free. The deadline is next Saturday, September 14th. Submissions can be made at socialartandculture.info.
Reverend Barber. Good morning.
And we're back.
Good morning.
Roger, okay, here. Good morning, WPFW What's at Stake listeners. We were just about to have our guests, Dr. Dennis Rogers and Kevin Satterfield, introduce themselves so our WPFW family can be reminded of who's joining us and what they bring to the table in this conversation. So, Dennis, by virtue of you being a D before K, why don't you get us started?
Okay. So, hello. Yes. So, as I was indicating right before we transition here, so I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm born in the city of Raleigh, which is where the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was founded, and that's the location where Jesse Jackson actually announced his 1984 bid for the presidency. The state of North Carolina, that's the capital of the state, is also where the spirit of Jesse Helms is alive and well. We have a Democratic governor, a Republican House controlled. It's the state of Wilmington, North Carolina, the massacre of 1898. So we've seen these pictures before. We've seen these images before. And this has shaped my mind, and I bring this to you today and the WPFW listening audience. Shall I continue a bit? Well, I will until you stop me. So, you know, in addition to 9/11, we know that there were African-American firefighters, members of the International Brotherhood of Firefighters, who actually climbed ladders on that fateful day and that paid the ultimate sacrifice. And so in us remembering 9/11, we want to specifically remember International Brotherhood of Firefighters, which were African Americans who, again, paid the ultimate sacrifice. That's my introduction. Are you still with me?
Yes, I so appreciate you really highlighting that, because I think those are the kinds of details, one, that we just don't always have, and two, even when we have them, they get lost in the conversations, you know, moving forward. So Dr. Rogers, thank you so very much for pointing that out.
You're so welcome.
Okay, we also have with us this morning Kevin Satterfield, and we're trying to get a connection with him. Kevin?
While we do, would you care for me to kind of set up what we saw last night?
While we're waiting for him to connect, Dr. Rogers, the debate last night. Tell us what your first impression was.
My first impression was that Kamala Harris won on both style and substance. When she came out, extended her hand, walked into the physical space that was the space that, you know, Donald Trump operated in. We know how important having our space is. She was assertive and not aggressive. She was cordial, and she was taking care of business as she would if she was in a court of law. So she faced the opposition with respect, and then when she turned around and went to the podium, she immediately dove into, you know, the issues, which we'll get into the weeds of it. So on style, you know, although if you look at just the images with no words, you see a grimace on President Trump's face and you see a smile on Vice President Harris's face. And there were moments when she just kind of shook her head almost in disbelief, like, can you believe he said that? And this is reminiscent of President Biden's response to some of the outlandish claims made by former President Trump on style. And then on substance, when you got into the truth of the matter, if you do a fact check, for the most part, Donald Trump had a lot of falsehoods. He had a lot of out of context made statements. And as a result, in terms of who told the most truth, whether you believe their truth or not, whether you agree with their truth or not, Kamala Harris told more truths than did Donald Trump. And so on both fact check, on the way she presented the case, at points she was a preacher, at points she was a prosecutor, at points she was a concerned big sister, a mother of children, although, you know, she doesn't have children personally herself, but she spoke from that point of view. So she really gave a multi-lensed approach to the problems facing the nation, whereas Donald Trump is kind of myopic, maybe biopic, two points of view, heavy on gun control, heavy on police protection, heavy on prosecuting, you know, going after people that are here illegally, and that matter. And there's more to come, but that's my first impression was she won on style. And she won on substance.
Okay. So before I want to come back to a point you made in terms of Vice President Harris really honing in on this idea of mothers and children. But before we do that, Kevin Satterfield has joined, and I'd like to have him introduce himself and also give his first impressions.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ms. Young. Hello, everyone. My name is Kevin Satterfield. I'm an attorney from New York City. I'm born and raised in New York City. I'm a former prosecutor in Long Island. I'm a former criminal defense attorney. I am, in terms of resume, immediate past president of the Armistar Long Island Black Bar Association, adjunct professor teaching the course Police and Urban Community, and I am a public speaker on race and the law and the Constitution.
Thank you, Kevin. So please tell us, what were your first impressions of the debate?
Well, my first impression was, and I think it was important overall, is the same to draw a comparison between Reverend Jackson in 1984, and VP Harris last night, just to have the opportunity to show Black intellectual heft, to show that you have Black equality in terms of intellectualism and command of policy discussion with your white opponent. That's very important because that goes against the spirit and nature of America, which is the Dred Scott decision that says that Blacks have always been deemed to be not human. They can be treated as not human, not as citizens, and they don't have the same rights or any rights that whites have to respect. So just the fact that she was on stage debating a white male, not to say a man, a white male as a presidential candidate, that just speaks volume in terms of showing that you do have Black equality, which is really the reason why you have this strong, continual support for Donald Trump, who is a confirmed rapist, and we can go down the list of his transgressions and crimes. It shows that America has this congenital, meaning her natural inclination to have contempt for the notion of Black equality. So just the fact that she stood on stage next to him, the founding fathers could not even conceive that. When Obama did it in 08, you had that tremendous backlash that occurred in 2010 with the Tea Party and the Democrats losing the Congress. So I think just visually and given the context of what it means to be Black in America, to me, that image was so powerful and profound.
You know, I have to agree with you. You're absolutely right. The imagery was so profound. I almost felt like it was, for lack of a better term, almost an unfair fight. You had, the one hand, you had former President Trump, who seemed to be, I think I saw it on Facebook, often where people said, he's looking unhinged, he's sounding unhinged, because the things that he was saying more often than not did not address the issues that were questions that were posed to him. And then the responses seemed to be knee-jerk, very reactionary. And then you have Vice President Kamala Harris, who is, very poised and who is really, laying out as, attorneys do, really laying out her argument. And so it was such a stark contrast to her opponent. But I wanted to come back to a point that Dr. Rogers made earlier, and that was about Vice President Harris's, continued appeal to not only mothers and children, but also letting America know that she sees them, that she values them. I was wondering, at least I was struck
Young,
by
can
that.
I just say, I just want to say, Ms. Young, and I agree with you 100% when you talk about the unfairness. But now when you look at it in historical perspective, Black folks have always had to, in style and substance, be better than, give an image of being better than.
Yes.
Look
yes.
how the civil rights leaders dressed, always in suits.
Yes.
Look at Rosa Parks. She became the face of the bus boycott, not the young black mother who the NAACP deemed would not be appropriate in terms of image. Look at Jackie Robinson, how he had to comport himself. President Obama had to be almost Puritan Caesar's wife. And so that is a burden, which is the black tax that black folks have always had to suffer, that we had to give the appearance and the style and substance to be better than our white counterparts just so we can be perceived as human. Well, they can be knuckle-dragging, a fire-eating Games of Thrones type of characters.
Right.
And still have the legitimacy of being human.
Yeah, and I must say, and you know, even in the example of former President Obama, you know, former presidential candidate Jesse Jackson, I have to say this is probably the first time where the contrast was so incredibly stark. And it goes to show, as you said, not only do we have to be 15 times better just to appear to be on par with them, but it also indicates how we as a country, how we accept male whiteness, regardless of how it's packaged or what the presentation is intellectually in this country. So that's the paradigm. And so when we're, but going back to the point, and thank you, Kevin, for that, going back to the point of her really appealing to mothers and children, I was struck by that, and I'm wondering what you and Dr. Rogers think about this. But do you think that was a deliberate appeal to women, particularly white women, because we understand that white women abandoned Hillary Clinton in her bid for presidency?
Was that question for the good doctor?
Either one of you.
I'm sorry, I was off mute. Here I go. So, yes, I think that her number one issue appears to be Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process, if you actually watch any of her television commercials, you see a great number of young ladies that are there. You see a great number of women just visually. Again, if you turn off the radio, turn off the sound and watch the imagery, you see the appeal, physical appeal to women.
Mm-hmm.
And then in respect to her comments last night, she literally stated that she wanted to get us back to Roe v. Wade and the opposite position of President Trump had to do with, you know, abortion or killing babies after the fact. And then Gracie Davis, the co-host with Matt Lauer, actually said that's illegal in all 50 states.
Yeah.
So she gave an excellent fact check on that. And, you know, what is missing in the conversation, though, was this idea of what about babies in Gaza? So there is this tension with respect to Roe v. Wade and abortion in America. And there's also, you know, a tension that exists globally because all these issues are connected.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of her appeal to women not to abandon her, as some of them did Hillary Clinton, as you mentioned, they clearly, both of them, appealed to their bases.
Mm-hmm.
She appealed to the base of women, to the base of people of color, even to the base of the Latino voter in terms of, you know, President Trump's comments about, border, you know, military criminal, border criminals, et cetera. And so.
Yeah, I think at one point he said, you know, something to the effect of if we don't do better, we're going to end up like Venezuela.
He's projecting fear.
Yeah.
She's projecting a way forward. And in her way forward, it's inclusive. She stated, I have only had one client and that's the American people.
Yeah.
And so for those who are in the middle, who haven't made up their mind yet who they're going to vote for, in my opinion, she made a stronger appeal to them than did, you know, President Trump. Because we know who is going to vote for her. We know who is going to vote for Trump. It's mm-hmm. those voters in the middle that those statements appealed to last night.
Yeah, and I appreciate you mentioning that, because I actually thought that that was the strongest part of her delivery last night, was making that appeal to voters who are undecided. And I think one of the things that the Democratic Party in the past has been accused of, and rightfully so, is that it can be dismissive of some populations, of some groups of voters. And so I thought that Vice President Harris and her team were very cognizant of that. And that came through very strongly with her continued appeal to you know, making sure that people understood that she, as you said, had one client, and that was the American people, and she was going to tend to their interests and their needs. One of the things, and you mentioned, Dr. Rogers, that Vice President Harris's seemingly her primary issue is Roe v. Wade. I'm wondering, and Kevin, please jump in on this. When I was watching the debate, and I'm wondering, you know, how American, you know, others felt this way as well, but it did seem like, rather than, although the moderators, and, you know, hats off to the moderators, because I thought they did an excellent job, as you said, not only in fact-checking, but really containing the conversation, particularly when former President Trump went off the rails, because, you know, some of it, quite honestly, was very offensive. And so really being able to contain that before it just, you know, got out of control. But even though they both had to respond to the different questions about the different issues, it was really apparent that, in my opinion, that they each were more heavily focused on one or two issues. And so I'm wondering, from your perspectives, Dr. Rogers and Mr. Satterfield, do you think that this election is going to come down to a singular or perhaps two issues? And if so, you know, what are those issues? Because I was surprised, for instance, that it took the debate so long to even get to the issue of the war, for example. Like, are we going to talk about that? When do we get to talk about that?
Yes. This is Kevin. I believe it will come down to a single issue, which it always comes down to, which is the maintenance of America's apartheid state and to the extent that America is willing to make racial progress. Let me say, in terms of VP Harris having to appeal specifically to white women and children, she also had another delicate balancing act. Obama had the same thing. How do I appeal to black men?
Yes.
Because
yes.
If you look at the statistics, black men are worse off in 2024 than we were before the signing of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 or the Civil Rights Act in 1964. She did address it by mentioning the Central Five Park incident, the Exonerated Five. And so because, just like with Obama, there was skepticism whether or not a Democratic candidate will address the specific concerns or even acknowledge the humanity of black men. And she did that. So I think that's also a very important part to notice. Notice that Trump took a shot at her black father.
Yeah.
There's no public condemnation of that or discussion. And so that just goes to the continued continued hatred that Donald Trump and America manifest for black masculinity. I just also want to say briefly, in terms of the abortion issue, one of the frustrations I have, and Kamala Harris is an attorney, and you don't have to be an attorney about what I'm about to say, because everyone should know about Plessy versus Ferguson. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about bringing abortion back to the states, for the states to decide, That is nothing but what I say is called Plessy versus Ferguson, the abortion decision. Now, for those who may not know, Plessy versus Ferguson was one of the top three most infamous decisions in Supreme Court history, which in 1896 said that blacks and whites can be treated equally as long as they are being separately divided. So you can have blacks in the same trolley cars, but as long as the accommodations for both are equal, they can be separate. And so that's where you get your signs, blacks not wanted, colored entrance, things of that nature that really sustained itself until the signing of the Civil Rights Act, 1964. So when you bring abortion back to the state, particularly what happened was, because when it happens with blacks and with women, when you bring policies back to the states and laws, those states, those Confederate states, now tighten the screws on blacks and women. So that's why now, so I'm surprised and disappointed that this language of bringing abortion back to the states is not put in the context of Plessy versus Ferguson, when specifically it's played out the same way in Plessy versus Ferguson. Once abortion was declared unconstitutional and brought back to the states, then the states just came across was sweeping hundreds of laws banning abortion and restricting abortion, just like they did with race with Plessy versus Ferguson.
Okay. Mr. Satterfield, I'm going to stop you there, and we're going to pick up there. At this time, we'd like to take a station break. You are listening to What's at Stake on WPFW, and we'll be right back after the station break.
Hey, it's that time again. Join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K run walk for total fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details and how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 202-888-5484. That's 202-888-5484. Meet you at the park on Saturday, September 14th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. WPFW, making a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back to What's at Stake on WPFW. I'm Denise Young, and we are here this morning talking with Mr. Kevin Satterfield and Dr. Dennis Rogers. And we left off, Mr. Satterfield, and I have to apologize earlier for just calling you Kevin, but you and I, we've talked so many times, so I just wanted to apologize for that. But we left off with you talking about this issue of Roe v. Wade and being able to put it into the context of Plessy versus Ferguson. And so I just wanted to give you an opportunity to continue with that thought.
Yes, because it has gone back to the states. The states have predictably, the Confederate states, which is, you know, the majority of the states in the South, actually all the states in the South, and some in the West, imposed draconian abortion laws. Abortion, they say you can't have a legal abortion after 6 weeks, when most women don't even know that they're pregnant within 6 weeks of conception. Abortion that has no exception for the life of the mother. VP Harris talked about that last night. You actually have girls who were raped by their uncles having to go across state borders to get an abortion because the state that they were raped in did not allow for abortion for a 13-year-old girl who was pregnant by rape. And now you also have states like Texas are saying if you go out of state to have an abortion, we have the legal right to subpoena your medical records to see if you did go out of state to have an abortion, and we can prosecute you and the doctor who performed that abortion out of state. This is nothing but a Jim Crow America manifesting itself in the abortion issue. And let's be clear, when you look at Project 2025. They talk about a lot of issues, but the dominant focus and the dominant philosophy of Project 2025 is to throw America back into Jim Crow America. America before the Civil Rights Act of 64, America before FDR presidency and the New Deal that really didn't benefit blacks at all. America where women were second-class citizens, white women stay at home, black women have to go work in white homes to just sustain themselves and be sexually assaulted and raped by the white husband in the home. They want to abolish the Department of Education so we can bring back Plessy versus Ferguson in terms of a separate but unequal public school system, which we have now, but it'd be codified into law. So this is what we're talking about. To vote for VP Harris, it's not even about whether you like her or not. It's whether we can put the brakes temporarily, put the brakes on reverting America back to what she deems to be her natural state, which is a Jim Crow America, and crushing black life back into that type of culture. And abortion is the tool. Abortion and Project 25 are the tools that they're using to implement that.
Right. And I'm going to come back to a point that you just made in terms of when you said, it's not whether or not you like her. It's about really pumping the brakes on what, the powers that be, how they want to turn back the hands of the clock and have a very intense apartheid state, even more than what we're experiencing. But before we go down that road a little bit, Dr. Rogers, I want to ask you, since we were also talking about appealing to particular groups, when Vice President Harris discussed her position on the war, she was very clear, actually very strong in stating that she thought that Israel had a right to protect itself and, even laid out the groundwork for how do we get here to that point? And her argument or position seemed to me to favor a little bit this idea that Israel has this right to protect itself versus really encompassing the idea that there is this, not only is there this horrific war that is happening, but the state of Palestine is one in which there is so much loss of life, death, and destruction, and quite honestly, murder. And so I'm wondering how you felt about her positioning of that issue.
Well, how did you read it? Obviously she's towing the line.
Yes.
a dog whistle for those who follow AIPAC and those who follow Israeli politics is, does Israel, the question, the litmus test for if you're supportive of Israel is, does Israel have the right to defend itself? And it's similar to the language that's being used from U.S. civil rights litigation to do away with civil rights. That question is a trick question. Of course, everyone has a right to defend themselves, historically proven the way Israel is going about that business has been, with overdue, total unnecessary force. And so from those watching through the lens of the Israel-Palestine issue, she hit the mark. So too did Donald Trump, because Donald Trump went one further to say, no matter what she says, she actually hates Israel.
I heard that,
He said she would not even meet with Netanyahu when he came to speak before a joint session of Congress. And we know that that's because in her base, there are people who do not agree with the Biden-Harris administration's position on Israel. They actually feel as though the Biden-Harris administration has given the weapons, the financing, and the cover for Israel to do its business in Palestine, to push the people out. So much so that on university campuses, Harvard University president had to step down because there wasn't, you know, she didn't come forcefully enough against those who protested for justice. Columbia University's president had to step down. And this is a powder-keg issue in the election cycle. But both of them passed the test from the perspective of Israel's point of view. From the perspective of her base, she failed. In that moment, her positioning, you know, they say that the only baby talked about last night was the potential baby that would be aborted after the fact. Again, Gracie Davis fact-checked that. They didn't talk about the babies of Palestine.
Of Palestine.
And Cornel West, another candidate who is perceived to be on the fringe, this is a point he makes consistently. That, you know, there's a moral, and Vice President Harris used the term morality last night. She even spoke to religion. There's a moral obligation for human beings to say, we're observing genocide. The International Criminal Court said that's what it is, that they're doing way too much over there. And, you know, one thing that former President Trump challenged her on, he said, go back into the Oval Office and sign an executive order today. And, you know, they do have the ability, they're still in office, to make a stand on Israel, but there's too much momentum there for their administration. Too much funding coming into the campaign for her to denounce what's taking place over there today.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that to me the issue of the war it seemed to be the only place where there was a meeting of the mind, so to speak, between Trump and Harris. But I thought with all of the moments where he seemed unhinged and just the was spewing rhetoric and insults and other offensive comments, I did think that his pivotal moment, as you said, is exactly when he challenged her to issue that executive order. If you are, and so if we notice it, I'm sure the rest of America noticed it. So if you are those voters who are sort of sitting on the fence, what is it that, and I'm asking this of both candidates, what is it from the perspective of what Trump presented and what Harris presented that may be a key incentive or influencer for them to pull the lever for one versus the other?
I think at a level it's, do you feel safe? From the Trump perspective, there are people who all of their subliminal education has said, fear the other. And they have to resist that education, that subliminal programming to fear the other. If they fear the other, they're going to vote for Trump because that's his mantra, is fear the other. And then if one looks at the Biden administration, I think that there's more of an incline to give a woman a chance to run the nation. When you look at those images, for most of our lives, all of the presidents were white males. And to, you know, our fellow panelists' point, when now you have a woman of color who's standing there really representing global women, And you have white conservative women who want a woman to have an opportunity to rule the nation. Those white women in that cohort that's going to walk away from their husband, go into the ballot box and vote without their husband being in the ballot box with them, that's going to be an appeal for them, her status as the other.
Yes, and this is Kevin. Ms. Young, and further, you do not have to pause and call me Kevin. Everyone can call me Kevin.
I got it. Yes, sir.
In terms of what you were talking about, the state of Israel and the right self-determination, I actually laughed at the conversation because that was the essence and the contrast between the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X versus Dr. King. America, to the extent that she did, she said, okay, we'll accept nonviolent protests with the fire hose and dog bites, notwithstanding. Mm-hmm. But no, this notion of black self-protection, firearms to protect yourself, has always been, to use the SAT word, anathema to America, meaning that America has always taken offense. Historically, black men could not and black women could not defend themselves. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, you have a young black woman who was a sex slave to a white male. She kills him, and she was just sentenced 30 years prison time. And so historically, we did not have that right, and we still don't have those rights when you look at the disparity, racial disparity, and stand your ground laws.
Mm-hmm.
So America will always say and have always said, okay, you can preach the issue of nonviolence and have your black body exposed to violence in America. We will accept that. But when it comes to our bodies, we go Malcolm X and Game of Thrones. And so mm-hmm. that's the racial hypocrisy. Yes, Israel has the right to self-determination, but so do black folks. Israel has the right to protect itself from violence. So do black folks. But that was a philosophy that was articulated by the Nation of Islam. That was a philosophy articulated by Malcolm X, a philosophy mm-hmm. articulated by the Black Panthers. And America violently rejected that message.
Yeah.
Violently.
When you said
that, I'm going to answer that. There's an author by the name of Marimba Ani, and she wrote a book entitled An African-Centered Critique of European Thought and Behavior. And in her book, she outlines what's called the rhetorical ethic. And what that is the rhetorical ethic means when we say law and order, that means law and order for you, not law and order for me.
Mm-hmm.
When we say we have a right to protect ourselves, that means I have a right to protect myself. That does not apply to you. So selective application of these concepts, principles, and even laws are what we're observing in the Trump rhetoric. And it's, you know, there are dog whistles in there. There are ways in which he communicates to a very specific audience exactly mm-hmm. what he means. And it sounds, in his view, as though it's applicable to all, but it only applies to a particular demographic, a particular psychographic, a particular mm-hmm. set of people. Whereas I believe that Vice President Harris, in her rhetoric, in her verbal communication, she is, in fact, applying it to America writ large.
I absolutely agree. Okay, gentlemen, with, you know, about 5 minutes left, I want to wrap up with this topic, and that is, you know, Mr. Satterfield, you earlier talked about how it's not whether or not you like, you know, Harris, but really looking at the in the context of this country is trying to go back. They're trying to be more intensive, more deliberate with this apartheid state, and so what we have to be willing to do is to look at the bigger picture and how we are able to halt that. And I know that that has been a conversation repeatedly, you know, across elections,
particularly or specifically with Black people, and this idea that we have to, that we must support the Democratic Party. And so my question to you, and actually both of you, is when we are looking at this debate, we now have it under our belts. There's obvious, I'm sure there's going to be a vice presidential debate. But what is the message? What do we say to, or what should the campaign or community members or whatever, what should we be saying to Black people about this notion of we have to be able to vote Democratic? And if so, what are we going to do after the fact? Because it seems to me that there's always a disconnect that once an election has happened, that there is a disconnect between what we should be doing moving forward. So I'm curious about that messaging.
Yes, this is Kevin. I'll just go and answer briefly. It goes back what Colin Kaepernick said a few years ago. He said he didn't see the need to vote. And there was just great outrage. But you can definitely argue that he had the right idea. As I stated before, when you look at Black progress since the Civil Rights Act of 64, if you look at Black progress in South Africa since the fall of apartheid, Black life has actually gone backwards. So there is a legitimate argument not to vote, because when we vote, you have quantifiably, meaning you can objectively track it, that there's been no Black progress under the Democratic system and with the Democratic Party. However, the big asterisk is this. The reason why you need to vote Democrat and President Harris specifically in this case is because if VP Harris becomes president, she will put on the federal court and Supreme Court judges who will embrace Black humanity and who will not be hostile to Black liberation and Black civil and human rights. So they will vote in the interest of Black bodies as opposed to vote against the interest of Black parties, which you have now with this Confederate majority Supreme Court, and which you have, of course, the federal court system throughout the country. That's the reason to vote for her, because she will place on the federal bench and Supreme Court those judges that will look out for Black life. Elected politicians will not look out for Black life because they have to take into account the white middle class, the white middle class tax base, and the white business tax base. So with that, and that overrides any Black concern. That's why you see no Black progress. The only Black progress Blacks have ever made, if at all, has been through the court system. And that's why you vote for VP Harris for president.
My response would be that the American Project, it is a work in progress. And similar to dental hygiene, it must be worked on consistently, daily. And that means voting in addition to agitating. Mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass said, you must agitate for what is right for you and your community. And so when we think of the voting element of the tools in our toolbox for social justice and political participation and economic justice, we have to recognize that while the presidency has the main point of view, things are happening in our state legislative bodies with our local city council members. Someone said, if you're looking at your community and you see the land around you changing, and you had nothing to do with the input of what that change would look like. A lot of people call it gentrification. The nature of nature, the nature of society is to progress. Either you're engaged in the actions that progresses society, which includes voting, or you're allowing others to progress society the way that they desire to progress society. And while we watch television and listen to corporate media, GOTV means get on TV for elected officials. But for our community, our barbershop conversations, our community gathering conversations, our kitchen table conversations are what's driving us to vote, but to also influence others we know in other cities where we don't live, but we have family, to vote as well.
And on that note, I want to say thank you on behalf of our What's at Stake listeners. Thank you for joining us this morning. To Kevin Satterfield and Dr. Dennis Rogers, thanks to executive producer Ms. Verna Avery Brown. This program is engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. And I am Denise Young. May we continue to be truth and justice seekers. Stay tuned for our next show. Wake up and stay woke.
Hey, it's that time again. Join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K run walk for total fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details on how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 202-888-5484. That's 202-888-5484. Meet you at the park on Saturday, September 14th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. WPFW, making a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Are you passionate about eradicating air pollution? Would you like to participate in the Environmental Justice Artivist Fellows Transformative Community Art Project in Ward 5, Washington, D.C.? We're seeking Ward 5 professional and amateur photographer portraits that capture the theme of what clean air in Ward 5 should be. Selected submissions will be featured in the Up in the Air mural design, which will be installed in a prominent Ward 5 location in fall 2024. Submission is free. The deadline is next Saturday, September 14th. Submissions can be made at socialartandculture.info.
This is Branford Marcellus, and when I'm in the D.C. area, I listen to WPFW.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words, Beats, and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults, with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy.
All right, all right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Bethesda Theater presents the SOS Band on Friday and Saturday, September 20th and 21st. Spyro Gyral celebrating their 50th anniversary on Sunday, October 13th. and Norman Brown on Sunday, October 20th. More information at BethesdaTheater.com.
Award-winning former police officer and criminal justice adjunct professor Garland Nixon hosts News Views Fridays at 6 p.m. Tune in to hear a refreshing angle on today's state of affairs and other issues other media intentionally overlooked. Find